to our origin of We the People. Tackling current issues, both political and legal, with common sense. As We the People, we must bring common sense back to make our lives better. Only on Now Media TV.
Welcome to We the People. I'm your host, Alina Gonzalez-Dockery, and today we're diving into questions that strike at the very heart of our republic. 43 days. That's how long our federal government sat in gridlock, the longest shutdown in American history. And while the machinery of Washington has finally lurched back into motion, the deeper questions remain. What does this crisis reveal about the health of our constitutional system? When does principled conviction cross the line into destructive stubbornness, as we watched the Democratic senators refusing to vote or voting no continuously when people were not being paid or receiving their food stamps? And perhaps most importantly, are we still capable of the kind of self-governance our founders envisioned? Today, we're not interested in partisan talking points or cable news sound bites. We're here for something our national conversation desperately needs: thoughtful analysis rooted in the timeless principles that built this great nation. We'll examine two critical questions facing America right now: questions about governance, leadership, and the delicate balance between standing firm and knowing when to compromise. So settle in, turn off the noise, and let's think together what it means to be We the People in 2025. So here's the situation. The shutdown is finally over. But until when? But the damage assessment is just beginning. Federal workers missed paychecks. Food stamps, or SNAP, was not funded. National parks suffered. Government services ground to halt, such as TSA and flights. And through it all, our Congress still got paid. But hey, both sides claimed they were defending constitutional principles. But here's the question we need to ask. Is this what the founders intended? James Madison designed our system with built-in friction. The separation of powers wasn't a bug. It was a feature. He wanted ambition to counteract ambition. He wanted different branches checking each other's power. Hence, the equal three branches of government. But, and this is crucial, Madison also assumed something else: that leaders would possess what he called virtue. Not moral perfection, but civic virtue, the ability to put the republic's long-term health above short-term political gain, which means putting aside the D, putting aside the P, putting aside the M, the R, whatever it is, and putting forth before all personal interest is what is in the best interest of the United States of America, the people, we, the people. And here's where it gets complicated. On one hand, we should celebrate leaders who stand on principle. The founders were revolutionaries precisely because they refused to compromise on fundamental rights. These are hills worth dying on. On the other hand, the Constitution itself is a document of compromise. The Great Compromise, the Three-Fifths Compromise, the Bill of Rights added to satisfy skeptics. Our founding document exists because imperfect people found ways to work together despite deep disagreements. Think about that. It was probably 30 years ago, 20 years ago, no, 25 years ago, that we were able to work together despite our deep disagreements. So when does a principled stand become destructive obstinacy? When does compromise become capitulation? I'd argue the answer lies in this test. Are we fighting for constitutional principles, or are we fighting for a political advantage? I would say that the progressive Democrats and those under Schumer were only going for political advantage. And it was disgusting because it was at the throats, foot on throats of the people. Are we willing to let the Republic suffer to prove a point? And most importantly, are we still talking to each other, or we have stopped listening entirely? The 43-day shutdown didn't happen because of policy differences alone. It happened because we've lost the art of deliberation. We've forgotten that self-governance requires both conviction and conversation. So what is the path forward? Our founders gave us a republic, if we can keep it. Keeping it means rediscovering civic virtue. It means leaders who can distinguish between non-negotiable principles and negotiable policies, not just grandstanding. It means citizens who demand both strength and wisdom from those we elect. The shutdown is over, but the test of our constitutional system continues every single day. So when should leaders step aside? Senator Chuck Schumer is facing calls from within his own party to step down from leadership. Whether you agree with his politics or not, this raises a fascinating question, and one that deserves transcendence, or that transcends party lines. When should leaders step aside? What's the balance between experience and fresh blood, between loyalty and effectiveness, and the long discussed and debated issue of should there be term limits? I mean, we're now seeing Nancy Pelosi saying that she is not running for re-election. She had been in office since 1985. Congress is not supposed to be a permanent state of power. It is not. So let's look at it from the founder's perspective. And here's what is interesting. George Washington could have been president for life. The people would have supported it. We just came out of the revolution. We defeated the British armies. We gained our independence. But George Washington was very wise. He voluntarily stepped down after two terms, setting a precedent that lasted until FDR, and because of FDR, eventually became constitutional law. Washington understood something profound. In a republic, no one is indispensable. In fact, peaceful transitions of power aren't just nice, they're essential. They remind us that we're governed by principles and laws, not by personalities. And yes, that goes to the cohorts that are in the current Trump administration, and Trump himself, who still denies 2020. And it was embarrassing to watch that he could not rise above it and at least represent the United States in a peaceful transfer. And I know I'm going to get kickback from that. But today's leadership culture has shifted dramatically. We have senators and representatives serving for decades. Congressional leadership positions became near permanent fixtures, and both parties struggle with the same question. How do we honor experience while making room for new voices? The traditional American value here is clear: servant leadership. You serve the people, not yourself, not your party, and definitely not those that are paying the money. You lead when you're effective and you step aside when you're not. The role is bigger than the person. It is experience versus fresh perspective. There's real value in institutional knowledge. A leader who's navigated decades of legislative battles brings wisdom that can't be taught, though can be mentored. They understand the long game. They know how to build coalitions. But there's also real danger in leaders who've been in power so long they've lost touch, who confuse their personal legacy with the institution's health, who can't imagine the organization without them at the helm. And here's what matters most. Are leaders accountable? Not just at election time, which seems to be almost a rubber stamp in many locations, but continuously. And that is a question on us, we the people. Are we holding our leaders accountable? not accountable to the lobbyists, not accountable to those who have the deep pockets, not accountable to the damn rabble, razor rattlers who are loud and extreme on both sides, but to those of us of we the people, those of us that are in that 70% that see that we have more in common than we do in differences. And yes, I am fired up about this. Are we mentoring the next generation, or are we blocking them by re-electing the same old people who are stuck in the 60s or the 70s? I mean, my God, Ted Kennedy, he was voted in his 20s and he died in office. Whether it's Schumer, McConnell, Pelosi, or any other long-serving leader, the question is not about age or tenure alone. It's about effectiveness, accountability, and humility. And then it goes back into who is willing to actually listen to the other party, who is willing to sit down and say, okay, set aside our political ideologies and see what is in the best interest of we the people. Traditional American values emphasize stewardship over ownership. You don't own your position. You steward it temporarily for the common good. When you can no longer serve effectively, stepping aside isn't weakness. It's the ultimate act of servant leadership. Washington showed us this. Cincinnatus, the Roman leader for founders admired, showed us this. Real leaders know when the season is complete. So we've examined governance in crisis and the question of leadership transitions. Both issues point to the same underlying challenge. Are we still capable of the self-governance our founders envisioned? Can we balance principle with pragmatism, conviction with compromise, loyalty with accountability? When we return in this next segment, we'll tackle economy resilience after crisis and the fundamental question of food security in America. Stay with us. Welcome back to We the People. In this segment, we're shifting from the halls of power to the lived reality of everyday Americans. Because governance isn't just about what happens in Washington. It's about how those decisions ripple through Main Street, through family budgets, through the fundamental question of whether people can feed their families. Let's dive in. So let's look at the immediate reality. The shutdown is over. Wall Street is breathing a huge sigh of relief. Markets stabilized. Investor and confidence returned. The financial sector weathered the storm relatively well. But talk to a federal contractor who went 43 days without payment. Talk to a small business owner near a national park that was closed. Talk to families who had to choose between paying rent and buying groceries. For them, the shutdown wasn't an abstraction. It was a crisis. This discontent reveals something important about our economy. There are two Americas experiencing very different realities. Our founders understood that economic freedom and political freedom are inseparable. You can't have a free people who are economically enslaved. They envisioned a nation of independent citizens, farmers, merchants, craftsmen who owned property, controlled their labor, and weren't dependent on government or aristocracy. The American dream was always about self-reliance within a framework of opportunity. Work hard, play by the rules, and you can build a good life for your family. I'm the product of that American dream, thanks to my father, who came here with nothing, escaping communism, and built a life that he never even dreamt possible. Today's economy is vastly more complex. We moved from an agrarian society to an industrial one, to a service and information economy. Most Americans don't own their means of production. They work for someone else. And increasingly, they're one paycheck, one medical emergency, one government shutdown away from financial disaster. More and more families are dependent on credit cards that are charging interest rates up to 33%. And the credit card companies want to now boost that up to 50%? Where is Congress on that? Meanwhile, those with the capital, with investments, with diversified portfolios can weather these storms because they can afford it. They have cushions. They have options. That doesn't mean that they should be vilified. It's because they should be rewarded for the work that they put into it. They created something that allowed them to be able to get through this storm and the next storm and the next. Traditional American values emphasize limited government and free markets, and there's profound wisdom there. Government overreach stifles innovation, creates dependency, and concentrates power dangerously, as we just witnessed for 43 days. And that power was within the hands of a few. But here's the tension. When government dysfunction, like a 43-day shutdown, or the fact that our congressional members and senator leaders have a pissing contest that they refuse to bend and are using we the people as leverage to deal with legislation that wasn't even part of this clean CR. All of that can devastate working families while barely touching the wealthy. What does that say about the health of our economic system? The answer isn't bigger government or more regulation alone. The answer is rebuilding the conditions for genuine economic resilience at the community level. That means getting the resilience off government benefits, breaking the generational poverty. Stop having that resilience that if food stamps stop or if HUD doesn't give funding, what will people do? That means building up people, giving them a hand up, allowing them to grasp that golden ring that is the American dream. That means communities that support local businesses, not just national chains, families that can build savings and own assets, workers with skills that have real market value, churches, civic organizations, and neighbors who help each other in crisis, economic policies that reward productive work, not just capital accumulation. We need balance. We need an economy where hard work actually leads to stability, where a government shutdown doesn't mean choosing between food and rent, where Wall Street success isn't disconnected from Main Street reality. This isn't about class warfare. It's about the founding vision. A broad middle class of independent citizens who have a real stake in the Republic's success. And our Republic, our U.S. democracy is dependent on a strong middle class. And you can see that historically. In the 80s, in the 90s, the middle class made up over 60% of the population. It has now shrunk to 40%. So now here's another question, which is a core question. During and after the shutdown, food banks saw dramatic increases in demand. Families who'd never needed assistance suddenly couldn't feed their kids. And why was that? Oh yeah, that's right. They weren't getting paid. Hey, Bernie, even though you say Congress has young people and they deserve to be paid their 100-something thousand, well, working class people, people who worked for the government, who've actually sacrificed by continuing to be loyal to their jobs, didn't have a paycheck. And this raises an uncomfortable question. In the wealthiest nation in human history, should anyone go hungry? Is food security a right? And if so, who's responsible for guaranteeing it? The traditional American answer has always been, you're responsible for feeding yourself and your family. Self-reliance isn't just practical, it's dignified. There's pride in earning your bread through your own labor. Dependency, even on well-meaning charity or government, can erode character initiative. And we've been seeing that. We've been witnessing it as our dependence on government handouts, on SNAP, on HUD, and other things has been growing year by year. Our founders would have found the idea of government-guaranteed food strange. They assumed citizens would work, provide for themselves, and help neighbors in temporary need through voluntary charity. But several things have changed. First, most Americans no longer grow their own food or had that option. We're dependent on complex supply chains and employment systems largely beyond our control. Second, wages haven't kept pace with the cost of living. For crying out loud, the levels of poverty haven't been really restructured. Oh, well, wait a minute, excuse me, I forgot. They were developed in the 1960s. They went a bit sometime in 2012 after the Great Recession, but they are a joke. It is a fallacy because somebody who is earning, say, minimum wage at $7 an hour is seen as above the poverty levels. A single income used to support a family. Now two incomes often aren't enough. Third, economic disruptions like a 43-day shutdown can throw working families into crisis through no fault of their own. This is the fault of the leaders, the very same leaders that have forgotten that they are in a role of governance. They are supposed to be projecting what is in the best interest of the United States as a whole. It is not about subsidies, trillions of dollars to insurance companies that have been gouging us. Also because of a failed Affordable Care Act or Obamacare as it was formerly known, because all of our insurances have increased to the point that many small businesses had to go under. That's not right either. So what are the rights versus responsibilities? Here's where we need clear thinking. This is where we need leadership to stand up, because there is a difference between saying no one should go hungry and saying government must provide food as an entitlement. The first is a moral statement about our values as a society. The second is a policy prescription that raises questions about dependency, cost, and the role of government, and also about keeping people down. Traditional American values would say the primary responsibility lies with individuals and families. The secondary responsibility lies with voluntary associations, churches, charities, community organizations. Government assistance should be a last resort, temporary and designed to restore self-sufficiency, not to instill permanent dependence. The best food security doesn't come from government programs alone. As we have seen, it can go away. It comes from wages that allow families to afford groceries, communities where neighbors help neighbors, churches and civic organizations that run food pantries, teaching skills like budgeting, cooking, and even gardening, economic conditions that create jobs and opportunity for even small business ownership, entrepreneurship. And what matters most, whatever approach we take, it must preserve human dignity. There's no dignity in hunger, but there's also no dignity in permanent dependency. The goal should always be helping people get back on their feet, not creating a permanent class of dependents. When someone falls on hard times in this economy, that can happen to anyone, we should help. But we should help in ways that restore their ability to provide for themselves. Food security isn't about choosing between heartless individualism and socialist dependency. It's about creating economic conditions where work pays, communities care, and temporary help is available without shame when needed. That's the American way. Not every problem requires a government solution, but every problem requires us to care about our neighbors and maintain an economy where hard work leads to stability. We're going to dive next into the principles that play out in our current political moment and the messy realities of how these affect our lives. Tune back in. Welcome back to We the People. Last week, Americans went to the polls in New Jersey, Virginia, and New York City. And what happened should terrify every Republican who cares about winning elections, because the results weren't close. They were a bloodbath. Now, New York City set aside, the Republicans didn't really have a leg in there or even somebody who actually was serious candidate. It was a Democrat versus a Democrat, even though Cuomo did run as an independent. But Democrats didn't just win. They dominated. New Jersey and Virginia elected Democratic governors by comfortable margins. Now, those Democratic candidates were true Democrats, moderate, those that never espoused any socialist ideals. In New York City, they just elected a Democratic socialist as mayor, not a moderate, not a centrist, a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. Let's face it, he's communist. He's communist beyond communism, and everybody should be afraid of it. But why aren't they? Why is it especially the white, college-educated, elite, young adults not afraid of it? Because they're pissed off. Hello, Republicans, guess what? That anger, that emotional vitriol that was driving MAGA, they're in power. They're happy. So now the pendulum's swinging to the other extreme. And that extreme is something that, for those of us that grew up with parents that lived it or who have actually lived, talk to people from Venezuela, talk to people from Cuba, talk to people from former Soviet bloc. They'll tell you the truth. So today we're going to talk about what actually happened, why it happened, and what it means for the future of conservative policies in America. Because if Republicans don't wake up to this reality, 2026 and beyond are going to be brutal. And let's face it, the Republicans, if there's a rake to step on, they smack themselves in the face every single time. And it's time to be honest. What actually happened? Let me be blunt. Last week was a disaster for Republicans in Virginia and New Jersey and some other down votes. Now, yes, it was an off-year election. Usually those aren't big. However, when you have, I wouldn't say deep blue, you had kind of a blue with a slight tinge of purple state like New Jersey and really what was a blue-purple state in Virginia, it wasn't close. It wasn't a moral victory. It was a disaster. Because in Virginia, Winsome Earl Sears, Glenn Youngkin's lieutenant governor, the woman who helped deliver Virginia for Republicans 2021, an immigrant, a minority, a former Marine, lost decisively to Democrat Abigail Spanberger. In New Jersey, Republican Jack Ciattarelli lost to Democrat Mickey Schirrell by a comfortable margin. And in New York, one of the cities suffering most from progressive policies on crime, homelessness, and cost of living, voters elected Zoran Mamdani, a 34-year-old communist. He's a communist. He could say he's a democratic socialist all he wants. He's a communist. And he's not a moderate Democrat promising law and order. A DSA member who campaigns on wealth redistribution, Medicare for all, free groceries, free bus passes, and all types of free stuff, and taxing even more the rich, which he doesn't have the power to implement. So let's look at Virginia. Because this loss is particularly devastating. 4 years ago, Glenn Youngkin won the governorship. Winsome Earl Sears won lieutenant governor, because remember, those are separate elections. Republicans swept statewide offices. It was hailed as the blueprint for how Republicans could win in purple states. Focus on education, parental rights, kitchen table issues, and energize the base. Fast forward to last week. Winsome Earl Sears, running on the same successful formula with the advantage of incumbency as lieutenant governor, lost decisively to Abigail Spanberger. What changed? Trump wasn't on the ballot when Youngkin ran, but yet woke was a huge issue. People were angry still. The MAGA influencers, those people were angry. So Youngkin and Earl Sears wrote a wave of parental anger over school closures, critical race theory, transgender education, but they also benefited from Trump staying relatively quiet and not dominating that race. Because remember, Youngkin didn't invite him to come with him. In 2024, Trump won Virginia? Wait, no, he did not. He lost, but he drove massive turnout among his base. He did incredibly well. In 2025, with Trump not on the ballot, those voters stayed home and Earl Sears lost. The New Jersey repeat. New Jersey tells the same story. Jack Ciattarelli ran a strong campaign. He's a moderate Republican, exactly the kind of candidate that's supposed to win in blue-leaning states. He lost to Mickey Schirrell by a comfortable margin. Why? Because the Republican base that shows up for Trump didn't show up for him again. And the New York City elections, well, it should be a huge wake-up call. Because what seemed to be impossible just earlier this year, forget last November, earlier, January this year, happened. Eric Adams, the current mayor, ran on public safety and won because voters were fed up with crime and disorder. The city has been dealing with quality of life decline, businesses leaving, and residents fleeing to Florida and Texas. I assure you, I am counting how many New York plates I see on a daily basis. This should have been the perfect environment for a Republican or a moderate Democrat. Forget Republican. Republican's never going to win mayor. I think Giuliani was the last Republican mayor. Let's talk about moderate. Someone with common sense, moderate, truly believes that it's, what's best for the city is spurring economic growth, lifting up the people, and being hard on crime. Instead, New Yorkers chose the most progressive candidate in the race. Mondami didn't hide what he is. He is a proud Democratic socialist. He's endorsed by DSA. He campaigns on policies that would have been considered fringe just a year ago. And he won. And on top of that, he had endorsements from very extreme Islamist community leaders, which would have also rang bells, especially in New York. Hello, 9/11. Anyone teaching that to the people and the youth of today. But what does that tell us? It tells us that voters weren't choosing between progressive policies and conservative solutions. They were pissed off, and a lot of these young kids were trying to stick it to the man. Hello, the King's protest should have been a bigger warning to Republicans and to conservatives than they let on. You have the pendulum swing going the other way to this extreme left that are pissed off. They are angry. I think it was Chris Cuomo who coined it as MEGA versus MAGA, because MAGA's fat, happy cat. MEGA, make equality great again. Bring in the socialists. We want everything free. We don't want to work for our stuff. We want to continue giving handouts upon handouts, because socialism is just the utopian environment. That's who was out voting. So let's talk about the data that should keep every Republican strategist up at night and figuring out what they're going to do, especially as we are now turning towards the 2026 midterm elections. Clay Travis and Buck Sexton reported something stunning. In Virginia and New Jersey combined, approximately 600,000 fewer voters showed up compared to when Trump was on the ballot in 2024. 600,000 voters. These aren't Democrats who stayed home. These are Trump voters, people who came out in massive numbers when Trump was running but couldn't be bothered to vote when he wasn't. Virginia and New Jersey aren't deep blue states. Trump was very competitive there in 2024, but without him on the ballot in 2025, the Republican coalition did not compete. The coalition that only works for one man fails for all. and it's an uncomfortable truth Republicans need to face. Trump built a coalition that's loyal to Trump, not the Republican Party, not to conservative principles, not to other Republican candidates, to Trump personally. When Trump is on the ballot, these voters show up in massive numbers. They'll wait in line for hours. They'll brave bad weather. They'll crawl over broken glass to vote for him. When Trump isn't on the ballot, they stay home. And without them, Republicans lose, and they lose badly. Also, make better choices for your candidates, even strong candidates. Now, unfortunately, I will say, Winsome Earle Sears, though she is strong, she is impressive, she's a Black woman, a Marine veteran, a compelling speaker, she's boring. She doesn't have charisma. Mamdani, tell you what, incredible charisma. But every single person who is in that type of role, trying to make that shift, trying to destroy the very foundation which this great country was created on, has charisma. Look at Fidel Castro. Look at Hitler. Hell, look at Khrushchev of USSR. They all had charisma, and they were singing the same song and dance. It's nothing new. It's the same playbook, and it fails every time. So why is this catastrophic? Trump can't run. This is his last term. That's it. 22nd Amendment limits him to 2 terms. Republicans will have to figure out how to win without him on the ballot. They had to figure out who the heck is going to carry the gauntlet, take the torch from Trump to win in 2028. We have midterms. Republicans have a very, very slim lead in the Senate and a very, very slim lead in the House. And then you throw in all the meandering, which that's another discussion for another day. Republicans need to figure out how they're going to get MAGA to come out, and they need to switch up their strategy. We're going to take a quick commercial break, tune right back in as we continue our discussion as to how the Republicans are needing to figure out not to fail. Tune right back in. Welcome back. So I'm not saying Democrats have this great, amazing strategy and that they're really looking at the people as a whole and what can build them up and how we can make them stronger. No, that's not happening either. Their strategy? We hate Trump. Everything against Trump. King's protest, which is hilarious, by the way, because most communist nations end up being autocratic, and we'll see how that works out. Democrats are realizing they don't need to moderate. They don't need to move to the center. They just need to wait for elections when Trump isn't on the ballot. But Trump is still on the ballot for them. The hatred for Trump is motivating them to the ballots. What is motivating MAGA? What is motivating those people that want to change? That's the answer the Republicans need to figure out. Look what just happened. Progressive Democrats won running on progressive platforms. Mamdani didn't pretend. He leaned into it. Shoot, he jumped into it and was bathing in that socialist rhetoric. And the Democrats, we hate Trump. If you hate Trump, you need to do it, because it is. It's about children still hating a man rather than looking at the policies and whether those policies will actually better their lives or if they're even sustainable. And Republicans keep getting something wrong. They think Democratic voters will eventually get tired of being motivated by Trump hatred. They think at some point the Democrats will need some type of vision, a positive message, or at least a plan and a goal, not just say, hey, everything's going to be free, people, and we hate Trump and we're going to defy him. Last week proved that's wrong, dead wrong. The progressive base is still running on pure opposition to Trump and everything MAGA represents. And it's working, not just when Trump is on the ballot, but even when he's not. The key difference, Democratic voters motivated by anti-Trump sentiment will vote in every election. not just when Trump is running. They see every election as a chance to stop MAGA, to resist Trumpism, to prevent Trump comeback, to repeal whatever it is that is happening. Republican voters motivated by pro-Trump sentiment only vote when he is on the ballot. They're not voting for conservatism. They're not voting Republican. They're voting Trump. So how do you stoke the flames of this newfound patriotism or conservatism? Or, hey, how about just reaching out a hand and getting people interested and realizing that if what they believe in is so core, how do you continue that? Do they wish it to continue? Because Trump is not running again, guys. Doesn't matter how much he likes to joke and kid and get everybody riled up about it. He's not. All the talk about how voters were rejecting progressive outreach, about how the pendulum was swinging back toward common sense and moderation. That's not the talking point. Because the pendulum isn't swinging right. You know what happened? It did swing right because people were pissed off. And now you had them all happy and saying, oh, no, look, we got Trump. We got MAGA points. We're actually going forward with what is what we want. And the pendulum quickly swings to, hey, we're pissed off over here and we can't get jobs and we can't buy property and we can't afford apartments. Oh, hey, we want to stick it to our parents who are boomers or Gen Xers and they're MAGA or whatever. We hate Trump. It's not about identity politics either. Republicans need to be terrified. They need to wake up because the Democratic strategy is sustainable at least through 2028. And Republicans are facing a turnout crisis. 600,000 fewer voters in just two states, a base that only shows up for Trump. And Democrats are winning with progressive candidates. And that should scare everybody in the United States. What we're seeing happening in New York City, or at least we'll see what happens. I mean, a lot of his promises he made are already being debunked. But also look at Dearborn, Michigan. Look at some of these other very progressive. Hell, look at California. They're leaving in droves too, people. It's not a utopia there either. And Republicans, what is your response? Trump is out there telling the voters not to use early voting or mail-in ballots. They should, you know, still forcing the issue of getting rid of early voting. Why? It worked so damn well in 2024. It worked extremely well. Getting out the vote, getting people to put in their mail-in ballots, early voting, things like that. Guess what? That closed the gap because the Democrats have been using that system for decades and it's about time. It was like, oh my God, are the Republicans finally waking up to this century and going, hey, you know, maybe we should copy this strategy because it works. Well, you know what? Keep doing it. Why the hell is Trump freaking saying we need to abolish this? Oh, and Republicans, don't go out and vote, because let me tell you something. When you have early votes that are already in the hundreds of thousands or in the millions for a Democratic candidate, the day of election is almost impossible to catch up. We saw it in 2020. So why do you want to repeat it? Why? Wake up. This is the reality. Stop thinking this is the 1950s. Trump, stop shooting everybody else in the foot because you want this. Oh, and by the way, yes, maybe the filibuster should be removed for purposes of avoiding a government shutdown, only for CRs, not completely. Because let me tell you something, the Democrats will come into power. And if you get rid of that filibuster, we are all screwed. I know, very negative, but it's true. Because I'm not saying because it's a Republican thing or a Democrat thing. I'm talking we the people, because common sense is still failing. Our leadership, our elected leaders who are only more concerned about how to maintain power, how to continue to get the money in from the PACs and their lobbyists, instead of what is common sense and what is in the best interest of we the people. how to build this country, how to expand people's ability and potential and opportunities, how to ensure that our new future generations have a place that is free. That, you know what? Public conversations, discourse, debate is allowed and you don't have violence or just complete silence. Democrats banked hundreds of thousands of votes early in Virginia and New Jersey. They knew exactly who had voted and who hadn't. They could focus their get out the vote efforts on people who hadn't voted yet. Republicans tell their voters to wait until election days because that's the traditional time and that's when it should be. You don't catch up. 600,000 voters did not show up. That is a huge wake-up call. And it's also should be a wake-up call to President Trump himself. Stop telling people they should abolish early voting. It's in. It's here. Learn how to take advantage of it and use it. Take the Democratic strategies and put it towards Republican. You guys did it in 2024. That's why Trump is in that White House now. And okay, setting aside the Biden debacle and Kamala Harris being one of the worst candidates ever to be chosen, or not chosen, excuse me, that's right. They just threw her in there without your votes. Another issue for another day. But logically, Republicans do have a turnout problem and they need to stop shooting themselves in the foot. Stop stepping on the rakes. Stop looking for ways to lose. And now people will say, but what about election integrity? What about fraud? Election integrity matters. We need to have secure systems, verification processes, and yes, transparency and showing ID is part of that process. We have to show ID to cash a check. You have to show ID to get on a plane. You have to show ID to do most anything. Hell, guess what? You have to show ID in order to sign a notarized document. People have identification. And here's even what else is insane. The MAGA base is the most motivated part of the Republican coalition. These are people who love Trump, believe in the movement, who want to win. And they're telling them, that's okay, don't vote early. Don't vote by mail. These methods are suspicious. Those don't look right. Why? Start using that system. It's not illegal. It's already been found. We have it. Utilize it. It is something that's important. And by the way, especially coming from the Southwest Florida, mail-in ballots are a huge assistance to the elderly people. So last week wasn't a blip. It wasn't bad luck. It wasn't about messaging or candidate quality. It was a warning. The Republican coalition is broken without Trump on the ballot. And they better get their act together or we're going to be seeing a long wave of Democrats. 2026 midterms are around the corner. Time to wake up, Repubs. The warning signs are flashing. And it's just a question of, are you paying attention? Thanks for facing reality with me today. Until next time, demand better strategy, better leadership, and better results for those who claim to represent you. Make accountability matter. I am Alina Gonzalez-Dockery, and this is another episode of We the People. Good night.